Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
How could evolutionary theory be wrong when it is accepted by most of the top scientists in biology and related fields? That's a difficult thing to face today, that we are in a society where evolution is accepted by most of the top men in these fields, and that makes it very difficult for a person to hold different view, to feel like you're the odd person. You're the person who is swimming upstream, something of that variety. It should give us a little bit of encouragement to realize that this argument is not a very strong argument as regards its structure. And the way to see that is to take the same argument and put in a few slightly different features to it. How could the geocentric theory be wrong when it was accepted by most of the top scientists in astronomy and related fields? Now, the crucial change I've made there isn't a change in the verb. Change from is to was. You see, Monday morning quarterbacks don't fumble. It's very easy to look back in the past and say, look how stupid those guys were, they botched it up. We cannot have that perspective on our own times until they're past. The only way to get that kind of perspective on our time, perhaps, or come anywhere near that perspective on our times, is to be fairly humble about what men are able to attain in each period. And one way to get that is to read stuff outside your own period of time. Not to be immersed only in what's going on at the moment, where everything seems to be new and better, but also see the mistakes that people made in past generations and some of the ideas that people had in past generations, which may have passed out of favor, but might in fact be true. And so we want to look at the theory of evolution, try to examine some scientific problems with regard to it. This is not a... not an exegetical treatment of scripture, anything of that sort. Just looking at scientific areas in relationship to the theory of evolution. Before we get in any further to this area, I want to look at a reason why many evolutionists consider that there is no other valid alternative to evolution. And that really comes down to an important idea believed by most evolutionists, not all evolutionists, but many, many influential evolutionists believe that there is no such thing as the supernatural. The natural is all that exists. We live in a universe that is closed with regard to outside intervention, if those terms would mean anything at all. Everything occurs according to natural laws, and that's all there is. And therefore, any explanation which is supernatural is ruled out. Others may rule it out on the basis that it's a more complicated explanation, or it's an explanation that you only bring in last. I'd say, well, the supernatural may occur, but it would be the last thing we'd ever come to. Well, you'll come to it at the last judgment then, I guess. But a methodology that by definition orders what sort of causes you're going to look at before you've ever looked at them may be very bad if you never get through the list, particularly if the right answer is down the list a long ways. But there are many people who believe that there isn't any such thing as a supernatural, that we live in a universe that is purely naturalistic. Well, if you believe that, then the fact that plants, animals, and men now exist either means one of two things. They've either always existed. To my knowledge, I know of no one who holds that view. Plants, animals, and men have always existed. Or they came to be by purely natural process, which may be not the particular variety of evolution that we would call Darwinian or Neo-Darwinian or something of that sort, but it would surely have to be some sort of evolution, because evolution, in broadest definition, is a natural way in which present life has arisen. So quite often, then, when you see statements in high school and college texts to the statement that there is no other reasonable alternative to evolution and things of that sort, the person is really saying the idea of the supernatural is not reasonable. Just what load of freight the term reasonable is carrying there, you have to check around. You have to be on your guard. It's very strange that one would say the idea of the supernatural is unreasonable, whereas the idea of natural law is reasonable, whereas in fact the one of them involves a reasoning being doing something, and the other one involves no reasoning being doing anything. Very strange that one should say miracle is unreasonable, but the biblical statement is it's done by a reasonable being. natural law is reasonable, though in fact in the view of natural law with no God, there's nothing of rationality connected with it. So, very strange thing. Well, just those words to show you, one, there's a very strong psychological pressure in favor of evolution today because of its dominance in biological and related circles. And two, this is really, to a certain extent anyway, due to a presupposition in many men's minds that Newton and men after him showed that the world was purely a matter of natural laws and therefore no other explanation need be sought for any phenomena. Well, let's look then at evolution, and I want to try and subdivide it into several categories in the form of statements, various propositions which are logically somewhat independent of one another, do not have equal amount of data or equal amount of evidence for one another. First of all, the statement, the principle, the assumption, if you like, that life has arisen from non-life by purely natural processes. The question of the origin of life. If you don't have that, then you do not have a non-theistic evolution. You do not have a naturalistic evolution. And if that has not occurred, then a purely naturalistic evolution is, by definition, wrong, I would say, and one's position is very much undercut in that area. Would not, that says nothing, of course, to theistic evolution. Secondly, more complicated plants and animals have developed naturally from one or a few simple life forms. Given that you've got certain life forms either at one time or by several processes that operate independently of one another, then all the life forms that we now see of more complicated sorts have come up naturally from one or a few of the simple life forms. Included in this, but I make it a separate category, man has developed naturally from the more complicated animals. And fourthly, at present, changes are occurring in plants, animals, and man by means of natural selection of mutations. These changes are passed on to later generations. What we basically have then is a question of the origin of life, the first one, two, the origin of the various plants and animals, given that life now exists, three, the origin of man, given that the animals and such exist, and four, question of whether or not processes are going on today, which might be called evolutionary, but says nothing about whether these things follow. For evolution as it is presently viewed today, and we'd say evolution of a non-theistic sort, you really have to have all four of these, or some, yeah, well, you have to have all four of them, let's say, statement. We'd like to look then at each of these four briefly in the time we have available. Let's look first of all then at the statement, life has arisen from non-life by purely natural processes. To do this, we have to discuss life a little bit, what life is. I'm not going to make an attempt to give a definition of life. One can define life in a number of different ways. But I will take it that a cell, a single cell in a more complicated animal, organism, or a single cell which can function by itself in various ways, we'll say, is life. There are structures simpler than cells that could be considered living, although it's difficult to know what to do with something like a virus that seems to depend upon higher forms of life to function itself. And therefore, if you removed all the other, it would not appear that viruses could function. They may well have developed out of something which could function without other life forms around, but they certainly don't operate that way now. A cell is a pretty complicated thing, even though the usual sorts of diagrams that you see of cells have maybe five or six structures in them of various sorts. You have a membrane which to a certain extent isolates the cell from its outer environment and to a certain extent allows selectively to have access to materials outside. The membrane is filled with a liquid of a very complicated sort, containing many, many different sorts of very, very complex organic chemicals. Within the cell, you have what we might call the control center or the library of the cell, and that is the nucleus. Nucleus functions as an information center, storing the information regarding how the various complicated molecules in the cell are to be constructed and then what reactions would take place which would be stored actually in the information regarding how these various complicated molecules are to be structured. We find that the reactions that do go on in a cell are very complicated. They are largely reactions which would not go on at anything like a high enough rate at the temperatures that cells exist were it not that they were all catalyzed. They all have certain rather complicated chemicals called enzymes present at the reaction, and the enzymes function in order to greatly speed up the rate of reaction or allow the reaction to take place at a much lower temperature. If you tried to do without the enzymes and raise the temperature a great deal, you would find out that you could get the reaction to go the same speed, except that all the long chemicals would begin to break up through the thermal agitation, and that would tear the thing down. If you don't have the enzymes, the reactions would go on at such a slow rate that the cells would not be able to grow and able to compete with destructive features of their environment. A cell has to be able to function with a sufficient amount of efficiency that disruptive tendencies of thermal agitation and bumping into things and things of that sort don't work faster than the reactions that keep the thing running. You also have in the cells constructions called ribosomes, where proteins are produced, and basically information is transferred from the nucleus out here to construct proteins. Your proteins are basically most of your structural material in the cell, plus your enzymes, the things that that catalyze all your reactions, are basically proteins. You have also another rather interesting structure in a cell, a mitochondrion, where energy is provided for the cell. What we would call fuel or food is brought into the cell and is converted into usable energy. Now, it cannot be converted in any simple way, because any simple conversion of your fuel coming into energy, what we would consider simple from a chemical point of view, in other words, a straight one-step oxidation or something of that sort, would release so much energy as it would greatly damage the structure of the cell, the very fragile molecules in the cell. So a rather long-step process is set up to get this energy out, and takes place then at a much lower rate. Therefore, you do not get into the problems of damaging the structure. It's very interesting that Carl Sagan, in his article on life in the 1970 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, makes this remark about the complexity of a simple living cell. He says, the information content of a simple cell has been estimated at around 10 to the 12th power bits. Anybody who's got a computer background knows what a bit is. For those that don't, it's something like a digit, something like a numerical digit. So around 10 to the 12th power bits, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. What's 100 million pages in Encyclopedia Britannica? It's 4,000 sets of the 1970 edition at about 25 volumes a set. So one cell of, whether it be man or a number of the other, even down to bacteria, and this is an average number, is really got an enormous amount of information into it. So that the step from non-life to life is not merely making a few organic chemicals, sticking them in some kind of a bag, shaking it up a little bit, and saying, ah, we've got a cell. It's much, much more complicated than that. And we see that pictured in this simple statement regarding the complexity of the living cell. Well, we would like to look then briefly at some of the steps which have been proposed for the origin of life, because evolutionists believe that in spite of this complexity, something in fact did happen to get from simple chemicals, water, methane, ammonia, that sort of thing, up to the complexity of the living cell. Let's have a look then at the steps proposed for the origin of life. The first step is to get from simple inorganic chemicals, such as are quite plentiful in various places in the solar system. Some of these are not very plentiful on Earth anymore. Water, carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, and to somehow get to what we would call simple organic chemicals. So simple inorganics to simple organic chemicals, such as sugars and amino acids and various things of that sort. This step is obviously necessary at the beginning to get from what sort of compounds you would have expected in the early history of the solar system, in the formation of the Earth, up to something that is necessary, a number of different chemicals, there's quite a few of them over here, to begin to build up the complexity that you have in life. Basically, you need some sort of an energy source. You have to have these chemicals. You need to supply energy. You do not want to supply too much energy because you can also tear these down. Some sort of an energy source necessary to get from this side to this side of the reaction. The usual proposals here have been that the Earth's atmosphere, early in its history, was rather like this. Ammonia, methane, carbon dioxide, water, perhaps carbon monoxide, this sort of structure, and then some sort of energy source to carry across the other side. What kind of energy sources would be available? Well, there would be sunlight, presumably, if it reached the surface of the Earth at this period of history. Even if it did not reach the surface of the Earth, if it got down to the atmosphere where all of these components would be available, that would be all right. In fact, it might be better if it didn't reach the surface of the Earth. There are a number of schemes that have been suggested here for just what the exact arrangements were, how these things would be formed and then protected. Miller and Urey ran an experiment in which they used as an energy source an electric spark, and they had a system in which they circulated the gases past the electric spark, and then they trapped at the bottom of their equipment where the large molecules that began to form, the organics that began to form, would be collected. One would not expect that same sort of mechanism unless you propose that there would have been lightning bolts or something of that sort in the early Earth's atmosphere. Well, there might perfectly well have been lightning bolts in the early Earth's atmosphere. I would have to say right now from my experience of working 5 summers with the U.S. Weather Bureau in college that we do not understand the present atmosphere nor the present weather. I mean, we may understand the atmosphere if you mean composition from top to bottom and lapse rate of the temperature and things of that sort. But I mean, we can't still predict the weather very far in advance. What we would be able to say now about lightning and thunderstorms or various things of that sort in an atmosphere made of this tends to boggle the mind. So you couldn't rule it out. You couldn't say that it is so. So presumably, it would be more likely that it would be solar radiation that would be producing this energy. But they used a spark, and then they used a trap to protect the things that were formed in order that they would not keep circulating past the spark again, because if they keep circulating past the spark will tend to disrupt them. So that must presume then in this model that you have to assume a rather particular sort of situation in the Earth's atmosphere in which these materials are open to a certain energy source, but then they are shielded from the energy source. At least a large quantity of this material is shielded from the source after it forms. And whether you have the gases in the upper part of the atmosphere met by solar radiation begins to form some of these, but then they settle out in the atmosphere quickly enough and get down where it's safe, either down below some kind of a cloud layer that would block out this material or down into water, which would shield them, something of that sort. You would need some sort of a way of getting these into a shielded location after they have been irradiated. So this particular stage involves several assumptions. They can be different depending on different mechanisms you want to try, but for something like Miller and Urey's experiment, it would presume that you would have, say, solar radiation providing energy and dropping down perhaps into ocean to be protected from the radiation source. There's also an assumption of the particular structure of the atmosphere early in this period. It's rather hard to judge whether this would have been just the right sort of atmosphere early in the period. Once the outgassing from the Earth begins, you begin to get a change from this sort of atmosphere, and that would complicate things rather seriously. So we don't even know for sure that this was the early atmosphere. That's based on some rather close details of the origin of the Earth. But it's possible it was such an atmosphere early in the period. So an assumption about the atmosphere, an assumption that energy sources are available where all of these things are available to make such a transition of this sort, and then an assumption that this material can be shielded in some way to protect it. That's the first stage. You certainly could not say that the first stage has been shown
that that's what happened in ancient times. You could say, this is the way it could have happened. Of course, yes, it could have happened that way. So we could not rule that out. But it certainly would not fall in the order of fact. I've heard people say rather incautiously that the theory of evolution is as well substantiated as the theory of gravitation. That is really overstating the case a bit, particularly if you're thinking regarding evolution that you're talking about the origin of life. If you're talking perhaps about microevolution, the fourth point here, we'll come and look at that in a while, and one might argue that that is as well substantiated as some of Newton's laws or something. The next step is to go from simple organic compounds to very complicated organic compounds, which we might call biopolymers. Long chains of these sugars, amino acids, and similar sorts of simple organic compounds to produce the very complicated organic chemicals known as proteins, DNA, and RNA. The DNA and the RNA are the information carriers in your living cell. The proteins are the structural materials, and they're also the catalysts for your various activities in the operation of the cell. For that stage, we have to then figure out how can we concentrate this material sufficiently to allow it to begin to build up. And you then need a somewhat different environment. You have to figure out some way to go from what would normally be presumed in the Earth as a whole, that this would be a very, very small fraction of whatever would be on the Earth's surface. Once the outgassing has gone on a good ways, we would presume that perhaps all, and certainly most, of the Earth is covered by several miles of water. So you're not going to produce several miles of this stuff, so you're not going to have anything like a 50% solution. You're going to have something, a very, very small solution, where it's even in solution. And yet, being in solution is a situation where you're very unlikely to do any real polymerization. You really need a situation of some sort where you can get this stuff by itself, separated from water, concentrated in some way. Well, if one assumes that you've got no clouds, so that this stuff had to fall all the way down into the water in order to be protected, then you somehow got to get the water out of the way for this next step to go on. So you have to presume that this step would take place perhaps in small seas which evaporate during a hot season or something of that variety, so that you leave all the water is evaporated out, or most of the water is evaporated out, this stuff is greatly concentrated. Or that it concentrates by being left, well, this would involve evaporation also, by being left on a surface somewhere where it can hook onto clays and things of that variety. Well, so a change in situation of some sort would be envisioned here. Now, to take this stage, you're going in a direction which would not normally be encouraged in chemical reactions. You're going into longer and longer chain molecules. That situation will normally only occur under rather high concentrations of your chemicals, so you have to get a very high concentration. You have to have the right energy sources and not too much energy source. The kind of radiation that would have damaged these which are formed will certainly, the far more easier, damage the proteins, the DNA, and the RNA. So they have to be even in a more sheltered environment, and yet somehow you have to have been able to have enough energy to evaporate this material down and concentrate it. That itself seems to me to run some problems, but geophysics is a very, very complicated subject. What's going on with meteorology, which stands between the energy sources and wherever the stuff is, what's going on with the surface of the Earth, whether you're getting heating from underneath, you really have got a very massive and complicated problem. And basically what has been done is to assume that conditions will exist somewhere on Earth that will concentrate these sufficiently and allow you to build yourself up to the proteins, the DNA, and the RNA. The next step then is to go from biopolymers to living cells. That's not so easy either. That involves not the matter merely of sticking some of these things together, but the matter that these particular very complicated molecules are such that they work together very well. That the proteins are specifically keyed to certain RNAs that are used to make them, that the proteins are keyed into DNA and RNA in such a way that they provide the catalyst for reactions where DNA and RNA themselves replicate. You have a situation in which there is a rather tight interlinking between these three kinds of molecules. Your DNA, your information for how RNA is made, how DNA is made, how enzymes are made. RNA, to transmit this information from its storage to the place where it is made, to the place where the reactions actually occur, by and large. Obviously, it's got to be some kind of reaction to make this transfer and some kind of reaction to make this transfer, but they're carrying the information there. And the information then is used to make proteins and is used to make the specialized proteins called enzymes. But the reactions that make the proteins on the base of the RNA information must be catalyzed. You have to have enzymes to do it. The reactions that make RNA have to be catalyzed. The reactions that make DNA, that is, replicate DNA, given that you've already got some, but you had to get some in the first place somewhere, that has to be catalyzed. You have a very tight interlinking between the system, and so the real problem that biologists and others working in the area of origin of life face is how to figure out a complicated interlocking system has gotten organized by a series of rather simple steps back to a simpler and simpler and simpler structure able to be traced all the way back into the DNA and RNA. Again, Carl Sagan has a comment in this area, which I think is rather striking, because it does say something very strongly about the state of the art in regard to working out how you get from all of these biopolymers over to something living. So far as is known, he says, polynucleotides, by which principally means RNA and DNA, have no catalytic properties. They have no tendency to speed reactions, and proteins have no reproductive properties. Proteins do not tend to make other proteins of the same sort. They have to have the information which you have in the DNA and the RNA. It is only the partnership of the two molecules that makes contemporary life on Earth possible. Accordingly, a critical and unsolved problem in the origin of life is the first functional relationship between these two molecules, or equivalently, the origin of the genetic code. How do you get from long molecules to long molecules that work together in such a way that, you'll forgive all of these anthropomorphic statements, one of them decides to store information, one of them decides to transmit information, and one of them, one set of things, and we're not talking about one DNA, one RNA, and one protein here. There are thousands of the proteins. I don't know what the numbers are for DNA and RNA. DNA, at least one for each different type of being. But how do you get these to work together? Is it merely chance combinations have built up a tightly interlocking information structure that is not simple? Sagan himself says the information content is 10 to the 12th power bits, dealing with a information content that is in fact comparable to the largest computers we've been able to build. I would be willing to say it's a little larger, but I've been out of the computer area for a few years and they've gotten quite a bit better. But that's really the problem. And when he says critical and unsolved, you at least have to say that the evolution, if it is taken in the sense of non-living materials to what we've got today, still has, and that's not going to say that they might never solve it, that's to say, still has a critical and unsolved problem at this point. So that it is a fact which we may base not only our teaching in biology, but also our teaching in psychology, and our teaching in sociology, and our whole question of what our government ought to be doing, and the whole question of what the world is all about, and what life is all about, would seem a little on the premature side. And yet, in fact, evolution underlies question and answers that are given to all of those questions, all of those fields or questions. Well, that much then for the first point, the origin of life. Life has arisen from non-life by purely natural processes, we must say, is at least an unproved assumption, and it's not one that you could say all the evidence points that way. You at least have to say we have found no mechanism that can be demonstrated to carry across the gap. So the theory of evolution at that point is not in the status of something which has got a mechanism which seems to explain all the phenomena. We come to the second then. More complicated plants or animals have developed naturally from one or a few simple life forms. Might mention here that not all biologists believe that it come from one simple life form, and the problem basically is that a number of the simpler life forms, there is no agreement on which developed from which. That is a matter of concern. We must also, then, when we look further up the scale from the one or a few simple life form matter, you see quite consistently that biology texts will give you various sequences in which various sorts of life are very similar to one another and develop in some direction, and they would say, here we have an example of what evolution does. We have a development of different species from one another moving up to the modern animal or plant, whatever is involved. And there are a number of these, which you'll see rather consistently in biology texts. It's rather interesting in this regard that George Gaylord Simpson, in his discussion of the fossil record, says that in spite of these examples, he just discussed a few examples of this variety, it remains true, he says, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera, and families, and that nearly all categories above the level of families, that's to say, the fairly broad categories, appear in the record suddenly, appear in the fossil record suddenly, and are not led up to by known, gradual, completely continuous sequences. This fellow is not an anti-evolutionist. He used to be considered the dean of American paleontologists. I don't know whether he still is or not. He says, later, it is a fact that discontinuities are almost always and systematically present in the origin of really high categories. So Simpson is saying something there that although there are examples of sequences where you see very gradual changes, that is not the rule. It is, in fact, an exception once you get, well, you don't even have to get up very far. Species. Most new species, even, do not see a nice continuous transition. Now, some of this, one can argue, I think, is due to the incompleteness of fossil record. And that's what you will commonly hear for the matter, that the incompleteness of the fossil record is the reason for these gaps that we see between these examples, even starting at the level of species in some places. However, that, of course, was the argument that was used already in Darwin's time, and Darwin expected that the fossil record would be filled up to a great extent as time went on, and it would fill in, and you would get these gradual, continuous sequences. Well, it has not filled in a great deal, and one was really inclined to think that something else has to be done then to explain this. Well, evolutionists aren't all converting to creationism. That's not what's being done. The two solutions that I'm aware of have been suggested is one, that the major changes that may happen in a generation, that a descendant of one being may be drastically different than the other being. You even hear occasionally remarks to the extent the first bird was hatched from a reptile's egg. Well, that's all right for the first bird, but to ever have a group of birds, you're going to have a double yoker, one of which is male and one of which is female, because that's the way the next generation is produced. So that's a rather problematical thing. That's been called quantum evolution. I don't know whether attempting to pick up the relevancy or the inness or something of the term quantum, but let that ride. Other suggestion usually has been given is that evolution has proceeded much more rapidly for some reason at certain points in time. Some people take this to be it has proceeded very rapidly because there was a higher radiation coming into the Earth at that time, producing many more mutations. So people talked about a solar outburst that sends a lot of cosmic rays to the Earth. Actually, if you'd say you get enough solar cosmic rays coming to the Earth, you will have a very strong evolution. You'll wipe out all life. And so you can't have it that high. And in fact, an outburst of that variety is going to increase the number of mutations, but it would appear that if mutations come too thick and fast, you're just going to wipe out most everything. Mutations are basically a negative situation And one needs to have a certain amount of stability and a certain amount of time for natural selection to cause the few good mutations they are to come to dominate the whole population. If you have a very short period of even a few thousand years of high radiation, it looks like what you're going to do is pretty well wipe out everything by either bad mutations being so common that the few good ones can't have time to catch up with them, or just kill the stuff off, period. Another alternative that's been suggested is that very small isolated populations might change very rapidly. It's not real clear to me how that solves the problem exactly. It does solve part of the problem that you can say they're in a part of the fossil record which we haven't dug in. We certainly have not dug holes everywhere on Earth, you know, and seen what's going down all the way. So you might say, well, the steps between this guy and this guy, say, and here we're not even looking, we're looking at quite a rather tight sequence here. The steps between those happen to be a small group of people between animals between Eohippus and Mesohippus, off in some valley somewhere, and it just happens that nobody's ever run an oil well down there, or no one's ever done any digging or something, and they're lurking out there to be found. Well, that's nice, but you would have thought you'd found a lot more transitions when we have by now. There are billions of fossils that have been examined and cataloged and that sort of thing. Well, that basically, just to look at the second point, more complicated plants and animals have developed naturally from one or a few simple life forms. The problem we face here basically is that the gaps are not rare, they tend to be universal, as Simpson says, that most, even of the species transitions, are sudden, not to mention moving up further up the hill. We need to look at another point still under this, we're still under more complicatedness, and that's a point having to do with randomness and evolution. Mutations are taken to be random changes in the information structure of the system. So they would be changes in the DNA, basically. Sagan again says in his article on life in Encyclopedia Britannica, 1970 edition, most mutations, however, turn out to be deleterious, bad, and often lead to some impairment or to death of the organism. To illustrate, this illustration is fairly wild, you might expect it of an anti-evolutionist, but to illustrate, it is unlikely that one can improve the function of a finely crafted watch by dropping it from a tall building. Unlikely is hardly the term, but maybe he got carried away on his example. I don't know of a case in history where one has improved the functioning of a finely crafted watch. No, a watch that was finely crafted but had a piece of dust stuck in one of the balance wheels so that it was running slow or something, you might drop it and the dust would happen to slip out and wander around somewhere else inside the case. But that would not be what I would call a finely crafted watch. That's a finely crafted watch that has been mucked up by some difficulty that you can kick it or drop it or something and improve it. That's the reason why we can sometimes improve the operation of a television set by kicking it. It's not as finely crafted as it might be, and it's not really functioning very well. But it's designed competently, and somebody has just not soldered something right, and you kick it in the thing where it is, moves over a little or something of that variety. Well, we should look then at the question of what random changes, that's the definition of mutations, what random changes do to meaning. We're in an information system, a system that stores meaning, stores information, which is used to construct all of the complicated molecules which interact with one another to form the life processes of a living being. What does random change do to meaning? Here's a sentence. This is a sentence. Okay, that's the sentence, huh? And now I'm going to demonstrate something. This is not particularly profound, I'll have to admit that. Making random changes in sentence. This sentence means something. You say, hold it, that means something in English. Well, I don't know what we're going to call the information system that exists in a cell. It's not English, obviously. But it is a system which has arbitrary definitions for meaning, an arbitrary grammatical structure, if you like, how the transfer RNA or something will know that it has come to the end of a sequence or something of that sort, how it knows that this represents this particular type of unit to be put in at this place, things of that sort. So it's got a grammar, it's got a vocabulary, it's got letters, we might call them, all of those sorts of things. Here is a sentence in English, and we begin to make random changes. I've taken it to be a set length, so I'm not fiddling with the length of it. That would introduce much more complication. And I essentially flip a coin. I had to use a slightly more complicated process, flipping the coin several times, to decide which of these things to change, and then to do another process of flipping a coin, trying to make it random, to decide what to put there. Well, the sentence goes to wreck very quickly. This is a sentence. It's the first one. That is still a sentence in English. All of the word sentence doesn't mean anything, my knowledge. It gets a little worse on the second change. A blank is filled up with a J. And by the time you've made only 10 changes, you can hardly tell that you've got anything there that you would be recognizable. And yet a mutation is taken to be a change that does something to the structure of your information storage. And what it does is random. There's no reason why what it does is going to fit the grammar or the vocabulary of the system. It will, of course, involve the smallest units of the system, the letters. Though it might not even involve that when you get down complicated enough. I don't know enough of the situation here, but it would involve the question of whether all the amino acids, say, that could be made would actually exist in living forms, and whether a change might occur, then it would require amino acids that doesn't exist in living forms, and what that would do. Well, it might just kill the thing. But you certainly are having a process going on here that is its basic effect is to destroy meaning. Rather interesting symposium was held in Philadelphia some years back at the Wistar Institute, a private foundation for the study of biology. A real hassle between theoretical mathematicians in information theory and biologists and related sorts in biological scientists and sciences trying to discuss whether or not mathematical phenomena are favorable to the theory of evolution. The biologists maintained that evolution certainly had occurred and that their basic mechanisms of mutation and natural selection were adequate to do the job. And the mathematicians, by and large, maintained that nothing resembling a mathematical model could be constructed that would actually produce the phenomena of evolution. Citation from this symposium that gives you a little idea of what was going on is this, by one of the mathematicians: computer simulation of evolution shows evolutionary theory to be inadequate. Attempts to simulate it suggest that the model is not defined in such a way as it will work. It doesn't say there is no theory of evolution that might not work. I can't tell that from this sort of statement. No currently existing formal language, a way of expressing meaning, whether it be mathematical or linguistic of some sort, can tolerate random changes in the symbol sequences which express its sentences. Meaning is almost invariably destroyed. So here you have a very serious problem of the changes destroying what is quite crucial to life, its whole information structure that allows it to reproduce down the line and that allows it to run a number of very, very tightly interwoven series of chemical reactions. Well, sometimes you hear the statement, well, that may be so, you know, that randomness tends to destroy meaning and things of that sort, but if you let enough monkeys type long enough, they'll eventually type Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, given enough time, purely random processes will produce something quite orderly. Well, let's take a very simple form of the same statement. Let's ask, how long would it take one monkey replaced when he dies, using a good foolproof typewriter, one that you can't push two buttons at once and crunch the machine, so that an IBM repairman has to come in and bail a monkey out for a while. unjammable machine. Given that it's a machine that has no upper and lower case, no use making this any worse than it is, this is all caps, we're going to have a typewriter of 32 characters. 32 characters instead of the 88 on a big typewriter. No lower case. We'll have fairly fast monkey typers. 3 characters per second. 3 characters per second. Not super, but pretty good. Pretty good. 25, 30 words a minute. Not fantastic. How long would it take one monkey to type the word, two words, Encyclopedia Britannica? So that's very simple. It's a short word, two rather nasty words. In fact, a lot of people, without having looked it up, would know how to type the word encyclopedia in its Latin spelling, but we're not worried about that, because the monkeys don't need to know that. The monkeys know that, you get a much different result. So how many monkeys would you need to do it in a year, or how many years would it take one monkey? Well, it works out. It's quite a bit higher than you think. I mean, that's short. It turns out that it takes 100,000 billion, billion, billion monkey years. That's the amount of work necessary, random, to crank out the two words with a space between. They're all capitalized already. You don't have to worry about that. Just that sequence of letters. What you've got to say then here, and this is airtight, what you've got to say here is that evolutionists are going to have to come up with a powerful selection mechanism to get the meaning we have got in life in any kind of time that's available to us. You say, well, maybe the universe has always existed. A steady state universe of some sort. That will not solve your problem. Because in a steady state universe, the stuff is always moving away from each other, and so you've got a radius of the universe in which there can be any information transfer. That is something on the order of a few billion light years. Beyond that radius, you can have no contact with that, whether or not the universe is infinitely large and infinitely old. And in universes that there seems to be much more observational support for, the universe is probably only 15 to 20 billion years old. And our Earth only 4 or so. So whether you bring in life from outside, or whether it started here, you're stuck with the same order of magnitude figure. That's all cosmologists worry about, and other people may worry about other sorts of things. But 5 and 20 are the same order of magnitude. You're stuck with a few billion years to operate with. You've got to get the 10 to the 12 bits in a living cell, but for a living cell of another sort, you've got to get a different 10 to the 12 bits. Obviously, a huge overlap, but some real differences. So you've got a real problem in that area. Well, I wanted to say something about two other areas, and I'm going to have to just hit it very, very, very quickly. Has man developed naturally from more complicated animals? There certainly are fossils of things that look sort of like man. In fact, they look more like man than they do like apes and such, which go back, would appear, quite a long way. Would seem that dating goes to 2 million years and so for some of these. Certainly if one would hold that creation had to have been just a few thousand years ago, then you're either going to have to fight all of this data of suggesting a long age, something, an old Earth, things of that sort. I'm not inclined to go in that direction. I don't believe the Bible requires a young Earth. You might say, well, could these beings be man rather than some man or something of that sort? Well, that's hard to judge. We don't know what Adam looked like. You're not told that Adam was 6'3", blonde hair, blue eyes, belonged to the Aryan race or something of that sort. We're not told what he looked like. He might have been short. You say, well, he must have had a big brain because he was able to do all sorts of things. Yes, he was able to do all sorts of things, but I think there would be a number of people in here that would be offended by statements that the people with the bigger heads have got more brains than what, in the sense that we use it, that they're smarter. That's not solid at all. They've got more brains, usually, unless they're skulls thinner, but there are a lot of things that have more brains. We do have to realize that a definition of man is a fairly tricky situation, but there are evidences of fossils of beings smaller than man. It's hard to judge whether they're as smart as we are or not. How do we judge that for an ancient man? Well, you say, well, he doesn't have a car. He doesn't have an electronic calculator. Of course he's dumber than I am. Well, if it was up to you, you probably wouldn't have a car and electronic calculator either. I don't know too many people who could go out and from scratch crank up either of those without some help from their culture. As far back as they can test the ability of the human mind, it appears that the human mind is about as good then that it is, as it is now. As far back as you've got recorded history anyway, it would appear that way. And one might actually raise the question whether the early human mind was a little too advanced to survive. If your survival of the fittest is going to adopt the idea that anything that a being has which it cannot make use of in its environment is extra baggage, which gives it a disadvantage in the race for survival, then it would appear that man's brain is much too advanced for what it needs. that the ancient brain was presumably capable of calculus. There's no evidence of anything happening in the Middle Ages that made the modern brain capable of calculus, and the ancient one was not. And yet you can hardly imagine anything you could use it for. Hardly imagine how the kind of brain he has got allows him to throw rocks better, or things of that sort, and yet those would presumably, in the usual caveman picture, be the situation you've got there. Some people would feel that there's nothing necessary in the way of a god to explain man, because man has now built things that have the same capabilities as the human mind. Would say, indeed, the human mind is just a computer. Is the human mind just a computer? Well, I'll develop this a little longer, but actually the human mind is not just a computer. The human mind is a computer plus an operator. You've got somebody sitting at the controls. I don't know how to say it better than that. Our consciousness or something. And a computer won't do a thing by itself, whereas the human brain does a great deal by itself, meaning inside the body and wandering around. But this really is a very serious problem to the analogy that the human mind is just a computer. Nobody's been able to develop a computer that programs itself in the sense of telling it what it's going to do without someone having done it. Now, operator here is a little too simple. I would actually mean operator programmer, that variety. You really have a more complicated structure there, which I've not really got time to develop here. But the point there on number three is that anthropologists are somewhat up in the air on an exact sequence from these early fossils up to modern man. They're beginning to find fossils which looked too modern, if you like, too far back. And that the problem of man's brain would not seem to suggest a gradual development, because it seems at various points to be far ahead of what would have been needed at that time for survival. It would at least require slight restructuring of the Darwinian theory of evolution in regard to what sort of selection pressure exists. The last point, present changes occurring in plants, animals, and man by means of natural selection mutation, these changes passed on to later generations. I think that's well supported by the data, that this sort of thing is going on. It's what is usually goes by the term microevolution. The problem is, can you get from that to the full theory of evolution without taking some steps for which there is not satisfactory warrant? One could understand this situation by merely saying that the creation had been set up with a certain variability available so that adjustments could be made in plants and animals as the environment changed. Can you, from that, get your whole range of variation that is necessary for the general theory of evolution, for the development of all the changes from the few simple forms? That's quite a different question. Can you get man? The problem there is, can random changes produce a greater and greater complexity of organized behavior? And I haven't got time to discuss that in some detail. Some conclusions here. In looking at present-day life, we see a very, very detailed organization in life, which suggests to us, at least rather strongly in the sort of experiments we can make, a planning rather than a randomness, and would seem, therefore, to go very hard against any kind of an evolutionary scheme in which the universe is on its own. We see also a limited range of variation. I haven't had time to develop this, but work with fruit flies and things of that sort. You can make changes, but you do not begin to get new organs that are different from anything that the thing has before, which function in any way, that sort of thing. It looks like mutation and natural selection is not the source of the whole range of diversity in living things. From the fossil record, we see that the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. I'm taking that to be true. But that does not appear to be enough time for the evolution model as presently understood. There seem to be gaps in the fossil record, and they would more suggest sudden intervention with their broad occurrence than that the fossil record is that bad. I mean, the fact that someone like Simpson or Goldschmidt would have to comment on the matter and feel there's something to be done suggests that they don't think it's a matter of merely fossil record. So either sudden intervention or very rapid evolution. But very rapid evolution brings you back to the same problem right here. The model we've got as it now is not even enough for a nice smooth line treatment as far as actual mechanism is concerned. The point here is not to show that evolution has been disproved. That's not. It'd be very difficult to disprove evolution. The point is, evolution has not produced a mechanism which can be shown even mathematically to carry across the complexity that we now have, given that you had simple life forms a few billion years ago, nor have they developed a mechanism that they show will work to get from non-life to life. Nor have they gotten a scheme to show how modern man has developed from the predecessor fossils that we actually have.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.